Lecture 22, The Mughals and the Marathas.
In 1658, a 40-year-old Mughal prince ruthlessly fought his way to seize the imperial throne. Significantly, he chose as his official imperial title Alamgir, Caesar of the World, to show his limitless ambitions. Over Emperor Alamgir's nearly 50-year-long reign, he extended the martial power of the Mughal Empire from its North Indian heartland, conquering almost all of South Asia, more territory than any previous ruler in Indian history. The Mughal Empire expanded into one of the greatest land-based powers in the world, but Alamgir proved unable to politically or culturally incorporate the diverse, regionally-based rulers and communities within the boundaries of his domain. The most prominent of those who rose against him were the Marathas. They were the dominant Hindu jati or caste, mainly of yeoman farmers, centered in the western Deccan uplands. Under their fierce and skillful commander, Shivaji, the Marathas eventually fought off imperial armies and began to conquer an empire of their own. Maratha power eventually extended out from their homeland across much of India. In this lecture, we'll look at these two competing Indian empires during the late 17th century. First, the Mughals, whom we've been already talking about, and then we'll turn to the Marathas. Emperor Alamgir consistently sought to behave and govern according to his strongly orthodox Sunni Muslim beliefs. Throughout his life, he was known for strictly following the devotional, dietary, and sartorial practices of an observant Muslim. He even paused amidst heated battle to perform the obligatory Islamic prayers on time. He renounced his own personal pleasures that diverted him from sober fulfillment of his religious and imperial duties. For instance, as a youth, he had frequently indulged in hunting. But as emperor, he relinquished that pastime. He advised a son, quote, "Hunting is the business of idle persons. It is very reprehensible for one to be absorbed in worldly affairs and to disregard religious matters." Although he had been a connoisseur of music, Alamgir came to believe that music improperly excited emotions, so he determined to shun it personally. However, he did not ban music for his courtiers and officials. Indeed, significant texts on Hindustani-style music emerged during his reign that imperial patronage made possible. Likewise, Alamgir closed the imperial painting atelier and stopped much poetry recitation in court, although some courtiers and women in his household patronized and savored these arts. His personal piety, he believed, would secure God's blessings on his empire and assure its triumphs over its enemies and those of Islam. After his enthronement, Alamgir began to purify his court of what he considered the unorthodox and un-Islamic practices of his predecessors. For example, he prohibited his courtiers from wearing gold or red garments, considered improper by many devout Muslims. Earlier emperors had weighed themselves against gold and other precious substances on the solar and lunar anniversaries of their coronations and births. Alamgir ended this practice, which he deemed ostentatious and anti-religious. Alamgir also terminated the heated debates among advocates of various religious traditions that his predecessors had patronized at court. Instead, he ordered his best Sunni scholars to compile the most authoritative legal judgments of the Hanafi school of law into the still widely consulted Persian language Fatawa-e-Alamgiri. Orthodox Sunni Islamic scholars always received his patronage. The emperor also presented himself as a leader within the larger Islamic world. He sent a series of richly laden embassies to the Sharif of Mecca, seeking legal validation for his reign. Alamgir's agents also prominently distributed vast amounts of charity in that holy city. But after receiving additional requests from the Sharif for ever more presents, Alamgir expressed his frustration in a letter to him, quote, "Having heard about the great wealth of India, the Sharif, taking advantage for himself, sends me every year an envoy. The sum of money which I sent is for the needy, we should take care whether the money is distributed among the poor or is wasted by the Sharif." End quote. Alamgir's 1690 mission to the other most powerful Sunni ruler of the age, the Ottoman Sultan, recognized him only as a Caesar of Rome, not the Caliph of Islam. Although the Ottoman Sultans had claimed the Caliphate since 1517 and had long governed Mecca. During his reign, Alamgir expressed his deep commitment to Sunni Islam by particularly favoring officials and subjects who did likewise, including converts. Meanwhile, he increasingly ordered constraints on Hindus, which estranged the vast majority of his subjects and a large proportion of his officials. For example, he reinstated the pilgrim tax for Hindu religious festivals and tried to curtail them. But Alamgir disturbed very few Hindu temples. In fact, he gave financial support to some of them. However, some Hindu rebels saw their temples dismantled, with the stonework sometimes reused in mosques. After ruling for over two decades, Alamgir reimposed the jizya head tax on non-Muslims, sparking popular demonstrations. The Maratha leader Shivaji reportedly wrote to Alamgir protesting that this was an unfair financial burden on Hindus. This jizya tax was officially payment for the privilege of living under Muslim rule while not serving it. So many Rajputs and other Hindus working for the empire were exempt. Nonetheless, Alamgir imposed policies that specifically burdened his Hindu Rajput officials. He reduced their incomes by assigning them less valuable jagirs, that is, land revenue awards. He forcefully intervened in the succession of one of their leading kingdoms, Marwar, located in the Rajasthan region of West Central India. The Rajputs of Marwar had long submitted to Mughal sovereignty. They had provided many prominent commanders and warriors to imperial armies. But when Rajputs in Marwar resisted Alamgir's intervention in their line of royal succession, he annexed Marwar. Alamgir threatened to do the same to other Rajput-ruled kingdoms should they oppose him. To break the economy and spirit of these rebellious Rajputs, Alamgir personally supervised as Mughal armies seized crops, looted cities, and destroyed temples in the region. Nevertheless, some Marwar and other Rajputs continued fighting a guerrilla war for decades, until long after Alamgir's own death. Even Rajputs who remained loyal to Alamgir received less prestigious postings. The overall proportion of Rajputs among the high imperial rank holders declined. Indeed, Rajputs eventually composed an even smaller proportion of Alamgir's high officials than did Muslim immigrants to India. The other long subordinated communities across North India also rose up against Emperor Alamgir. In the Punjab, the region north of Rajasthan, a new religious movement had arisen during the 16th century. They were known as Sikhs, which means disciples, since they followed a series of gurus or religious, social, and political leaders. These gurus developed doctrines that drew upon Hindu bhakti devotionalism and also Islamic monotheism. Increasingly, the later gurus united the Sikh community to defend itself militarily. During the early 17th century, the Sikh community revolted repeatedly against Mughal rule and repulsed several Mughal suppression campaigns. Then, the current guru of this religious community had opposed Alamgir during his war for succession to the throne. So Emperor Alamgir tried to control this community by deciding the succession of its gurus. But this interference only mobilized increasingly militant Sikh resistance against Mughal authorities. In 1675, Alamgir arrested and executed their current guru, Tej Bahadur. But Sikhs continued to fight for control over their homeland for decades, successfully achieving their own independent kingdom in the Punjab by the early 18th century. In 1681, Alamgir left the North Indian heartland of the empire. Instead, he spent the remaining 26 years of his reign in war-racked Deccan. Alamgir's presence initially strengthened the resolve and resources of his imperial armies. When his sons failed to achieve victory there, Alamgir personally took command over the costly conquests of the remaining Deccan Sultanates of Bijapur and Golconda. Eventually victorious, he annexed both sultanates and imprisoned their rulers. But their former officials, landholders, and subjects remained resistant. Overall, these newly conquered lands proved disordered and unprofitable for the Mughal Empire. Alamgir next committed his armies against the Marathas in the western Deccan. Seeking to co-opt their generals, he awarded official imperial rank and incomes to many of them, until they outnumbered Rajputs among his high officials. This raised the proportion of Hindu rank holders, which reveals that Alamgir did not exclude Hindus per se, as many critics of him have asserted. But these new Maratha officials rarely received prominent administrative posts and lacked any real commitment to the empire. We'll look at the rise of the Marathas later in this lecture. Other dangerous forces along India's coasts were the Portuguese and other European powers, especially the English East India Company. We'll discuss these more extensively in the next lectures. But from Alamgir's perspective, they were annoying threats, but not serious enemies. And the empire had limited success on land, where Mughal armies vastly outweighed the small European forces. For instance, in 1666, Mughal forces seized from the Portuguese and their local allies Chittagong port in what is now modern-day Bangladesh, not far from Burma. But Alamgir had no blue water navy, and so he was powerless to oppose Europeans at sea. European ship captains, both those officially working for the Portuguese or English, and also independent pirates, frequently preyed upon merchant shipping. Mughal officials proved helpless in preventing this. Some imperial officials even profited by collaborating with Europeans, despite Alamgir's orders. Hence, Alamgir scolded his own son, Azam, who was the current governor over the main Mughal port of Surat, in Gujarat, on the northwest coast of this continent. Quote, "Indian ships cannot sail without the permit of Ferengis," that is, Europeans. "The Muslim community has become so weak that even Mughal imperial vessels are unable to cruise. For the last 20 years, the ships of the Surat merchants and those of pilgrimage ships destined for the Holy Land are being plundered on the high seas. Steps taken to combat the problem have proved fruitless. Negligence, indolence, and indifference toward this matter are contrary to the Islamic sense of honor. Concession and favor to the Ferengis has been shown beyond measure. Moderation will not work. Severity and harshness are required." Close quote. Alamgir himself futilely tried to use diplomacy to force the Portuguese government in Goa and the English East India Company to protect Indian shipping, or even stop seizing it. As Alamgir passed through his 70s to 80s, he increasingly struggled to manage the empire as a whole. Neither his imperial armies nor his central or provincial administrations had the technology, manpower, or financial resources to control such a vast territorial expanse and an array of subordinated regional rulers and communities. Further, there were deep conflicting interests among Alamgir, factions among his officials, his diverse subjects, rival political powers, and his own heirs. All of these imperial weaknesses compounded each other. Alamgir expended considerable resources in his intermittent Deccan Wars. His massive imperial armies proved extremely costly and inefficient. Imperial encampments numbered hundreds of thousands of soldiers, suppliers, and camp followers. Cannons were made so large that they could barely move or fire. Armies that Alamgir personally commanded could still crush static opponents, like the Deccanese sultanates. But imperial generals were repeatedly frustrated by mobile guerrilla bands, especially the Marathas under Shivaji. Nonetheless, imperial commanders continued to expand. They raided kingdoms into the very far southern tip of India during the early 1690s, making those rulers nominal tributaries. But the imperial administration exerted little control there, or even over earlier captured Deccan territories. All this intensified the empire's structural deficit as expenditures far exceeded income. As Alamgir himself admitted, "We've a small sum of money and many have a demand for it." Seeing few of his goals accomplished unless he directed them personally, Alamgir concentrated imperial revenues and manpower in his own hands. Throughout his reign, Alamgir never spared himself. While he occasionally visited the capitals of defeated Deccani rulers, he did not live in their luxurious palaces. Instead, for the last 8 years of his life, Alamgir stubbornly moved his vast imperial encampment around the western Deccan countryside, assaulting a dozen hill forts held by Marathas and their allies. He eventually captured each small but stubborn fort after a long and costly siege. But he often had to negotiate their surrender with little benefit to him and little cost to their defenders. Overstretched imperial forces could retain only brief possession of these forts before they reverted to Maratha hands. One imperial official lamented, quote, "Alamgir, who is not in want of anything, has been seized with such a longing and passion for some heaps of stone, that is, hill forts," unquote. All this led many inside and outside the imperial establishment to question Alamgir's authority and to act in their own interests. During the decades before Alamgir's death, leading officials became divided into particularly strong and antagonistic factions, each seeking its own advantage, often at the empire's expense. Many officials needed powerful patrons to protect their interests, since their own expenses far outweighed their actual income from the emperor. Consequently, many generals left their soldiers and retainers long unpaid, which fostered disloyalty. Several officials eventually turned their territories into hereditary kingdoms, since the imperial center was losing control over provincial administrations. Overall, the empire began to segment as revenue flows and communication links between north and south were periodically interrupted en route due to predations by bandits, warlords, and even intermediate imperial officials. Most governors in North India faced regional uprisings without the prospect of military reinforcement or financial support from Alamgir in the distant Deccan. Conversely, most governors remained unchecked by effective supervision from the imperial center and were able to retain provincial revenues for themselves. By the time of Alamgir's death, few North Indian provinces were sending substantial revenues to him. In the Deccan, many imperial officials who originated in North India, including Rajputs and many long-settled Muslims, had been serving far from home through decades of frustrating harassment by local insurgents, especially Marathas. One official lamented the frustrating and interminable Deccan campaigns. Quote, "Ever since His Majesty had adopted all these wars and hardships of travel, the inmates of the camp, sick of long separation, summoned their families, and a new generation was thus born in the encampment." Imperial commanders often saw little prospect of defeating these insurgents or particularly benefit to the empire or themselves from doing so. Instead, many imperial generals preserved their own financial and manpower resources by negotiating private settlements with those enemies, despite Alamgir's repeated explicit orders for forbidding this. On their part, many new Maratha and other Deccan officials whose submission had been thus purchased had little loyalty to the empire. They often saw better prospects in repudiating imperial service in order to carve out kingdoms for themselves or to join leaders from their own community who were doing so. These included various Maratha generals and other regionally rooted warlords. In both North India and the Deccan, many tributary rulers, landholders, and other subjects, including peasants, artisans, merchants, and bankers, faced revenue demands from the empire, but increasingly doubted the value of paying. Imperial officials had diminished capacity to provide justice, law, and order, and also to compel tax payments. In contrast, local rajas and landholders often had bonds with the local population and retained more revenues, which they used to bolster their own power. Particularly in the Deccan, much of the economy had been devastated by decades of warfare and disrupted commerce. Expanding areas were subject to annual levies by Maratha-led war bands, that is, chaut, payment of a quarter of the revenue, plus other tributes in exchange for relief from even more costly plundering. imperial officials often proved unable to stop this redirection of revenue payments to Maratha commanders. As Alamgir aged, he feared for his dynasty, not perceiving much capacity in any of his potential heirs. One of his five sons had rebelled and then died in exile in Iran. Another rebel son had died in imperial prison. Alamgir had punished each of his other three sons at one point or another. Further, Alamgir kept them and his nine already maturing grandsons dependent on his cash grants and loaned military and administrative manpower. Hence, by Alamgir's death, none of his heirs was particularly strong, especially compared to the powerful imperial commanders and governors. Some later historians use Alamgir's death in 1707 to mark the end of the Mughal Empire, since none of his descendants proved able to prevent the empire from fragmenting. His eldest living son finally gained the throne by defeating and executing all of his surviving brothers and their close male relatives. Yet he was already age 63, so everyone knew that the next violent succession would soon follow. Nonetheless, the dynasty and empire continued for another 150 years under a series of weak emperors who reigned but rarely ruled. We'll explore in future lectures how this striking continuity shows the empire's continuing cultural influence, even when no Mughal empire held much military power. Displacing the Mughals were various rival powers that competed for domination over India. We now turn to the most expansive land power during Alamgir's reign and thereafter, the Marathas. Many Marathas were small-scale, independent farmers who worked their own land. Many were also prepared to fight to defend or extend their holdings against all neighbors and outsiders. As the Muslim-ruled Deccani Sultanates and the Hindu-ruled Vijayanagar rose in the early 14th century, which you discussed earlier, some Marathas served in their armies, gaining battle experience as soldiers and generals. The youthful Shivaji followed his family's martial tradition, rising through service in the armies of various regional rulers. After he emerged as an independent commander, Shivaji's reputation mounted, as did the spoils he seized. These continued to gain him many followers, especially Marathas, but including men of other communities as well. In 1659, early in his independent career, Shivaji famously assassinated Afzal Khan, the Muslim commander of a much larger Bijapur Sultanate army. During heated negotiations between them, the two generals grappled. Shivaji had concealed sharp spurs called tiger's claws in his hands, so he was able to rip open Afzal Khan's back. Marathas claimed that Afzal Khan had himself intended to kill Shivaji, so this was self-defense. But the result was that the shocked Sultanate army panicked, and Shivaji's well-prepared forces scattered them, looting their rich encampment. With such a rising reputation, Shivaji attracted ever larger numbers of followers. As Emperor Alamgir fought to extend Mughal imperial control in the Deccan, he sent some of his best commanders and troops against Shivaji, but they repeatedly failed to defeat him. Spectacularly, Shivaji withstood a 2.5-year-long siege by one of the highest-ranked Mughal generals. Then Shivaji unexpectedly sallied out in 1663 to beat the much larger besieging imperial army. 9 months later, Shivaji sacked the rich strategic Mughal port of Surat, which the much larger imperial forces proved incompetent to defend. This gained Shivaji and his followers vast wealth and prestige. Recall that this major Mughal center for overseas trade was also the major port for the Muslim pilgrims on Hajj to Mecca. In addition to their economic and military costs, these repeated disasters at Shivaji's hands humiliated the Mughal Empire. For instance, the rival Shah of Iran wrote tauntingly to Alamgir, quote, "You call yourself a padishah or emperor, but you cannot subdue a mere landholder like Shivaji. I'm going to India with an army to teach you your business," unquote. Stubbornly, Alamgir sent against Shivaji an even more powerful army under one of his top commanders, a Hindu Rajput named Raja Jai Singh. Partially defeated, Shivaji had to relinquish most of his forts and territories. But he received approval to retain the rest and allied with the Mughals against the Bijapur Sultanate. Alamgir himself sought to incorporate Shivaji by investing his 6 or 7-year-old son, Shambhaji, with high imperial rank and by summoning both of them to the Mughal court at Agra in 1666. However, like many newcomers to Alamgir's court, Shivaji was alienated rather than assimilated. One hereditary imperial courtier reflected the condescending attitude toward Shivaji, quote, "This wild animal of the wilderness of ignorance, who knew not the etiquette of the imperial court, went into a corner and made improper expressions of dissatisfaction and complaint. His brainless head led him to make tumult. The emperor ordered that he should be returned to his lodgings, in view of the fraud and satanic trickery of this arch deceiver," close quote. Then Shivaji deceived his guards, dramatically escaped back to his homeland, and he rallied his followers there. As the sultans of Bijapur and Golconda, various other rulers, and rival factions within the Mughal administration all engaged in multi-sided conflicts in the Deccan, Shivaji intermittently supported or opposed each of them. In 1670, Shivaji plundered Surat once again, adding to his own wealth and fame, and again humiliating its imperial defenders. Shivaji further enhanced his status by ordering his own elaborate Brahmanical enthronement in 1674, with a new status as a Chhatrapati Maharaj. This was a traditional Sanskrit term meaning universal emperor. Local Brahmins knew all about his family and the Maratha Jati, which was generally regarded as Shudras, members of the fourth and lowest Varna. So Shivaji invited Brahmins from the prestigious holy city of Benares to perform the ceremonies appropriate for a Rajput Kshatriya and a Hindu universal emperor. First, the Brahmin genealogists whom he employed discovered that his family had descended from an ancient Rajput dynasty of high Kshatriya Varna, although his lineage had been allegedly forgotten over the centuries. Neither Shivaji nor his recent ancestors had undergone the required ceremonies of a Kshatriya. So he in person and his deceased ancestors retroactively went through an expiation ceremony that cleansed them of those sins of omission or bad karma. Then they performed the rituals that all Kshatriya men needed to do in order to become twice born. Among his new titles, Shivaji added, quote, "ornament of the Kshatriya lineage." He remarried his wives, this time using ceremonies appropriate for royal Rajputs. Finally, the Brahmins performed the coronation rite, including bathing Shivaji with waters taken from all of India's sacred rivers. They modeled the ritual on ancient Sanskrit texts and also on the current customary practice of well-established Rajput rulers. Remember, this is a process that outside historians called Sanskritization. In addition, Shivaji eliminated many of the Persian language terms and titles that had been used by his administration, copied from the Sultanate and the Mughal systems. Instead, Shivaji ordered the use of the Marathi language throughout his domain. He also made elaborate royal processions to the major centers and holy sites under his rule. In these ways, Shivaji claimed that his regime stood for both Hinduism and a Marathi regional identity. His military success continued to attract followers. By his death in 1680, Shivaji ruled over 50,000 square miles, with a revenue perhaps one-fifth as much of the entire Mughal empires. Thereafter, the Maratha coalition remained the most expansive force in the Deccan. Even occasional triumphs by Alamgir failed to suppress the Marathas. For instance, in 1689, Mughal forces captured Shivaji's main heir, Sambhaji. Alamgir had him publicly humiliated, blinded, and executed. Alamgir tried to determine the Maratha succession by recognizing instead Shambhaji's 9-year-old son, Shahu, as Raja, awarding him a high rank and raising him within the imperial household. But independent-minded Maratha officials and generals continued to lead armed assertions that outlasted Alamgir's reign. Indeed, during the 18th century, as the Mughal Empire fragmented under Alamgir's weak heirs, various powerful Maratha commanders repeatedly led armies northward occasionally seizing the Mughal capital of Shah Jahanabad. They also marched eastward into Bengal. In each region, Maratha chiefs negotiated or simply collected chaut, sardeshmukhi, which is the additional headman's fees, and other exactions. Maratha forces also conquered south, but periodic internecine conflicts among the Maratha ruling dynasty, their Peshwas or chief ministers, other courtiers and semi-independent generals, as well as occasional battlefield defeats, all led to temporary withdrawals. Perhaps the bloodiest battle in all of Indian history was fought at Panipat in 1761. The Maratha army, with many Indian allies, fought against the Afghan invader Ahmad Shah Abdali. Both sides were so battered that the Marathas withdrew from North India for a decade, and Ahmad Shah left India, never to return. However, Maratha generals gradually recovered as the dominant force in the Delhi region. They fought the expanding English East India Company in three wars, 1775 to 82, 1803 to 1805, and finally 1817 to 18. Defeat at the hands of the British in the last of these wars meant the end to Maratha ambitions to extend their own empire across India. In the next lecture, we'll discuss how and why Europeans, and especially the English East India Company, rose over the late 18th century to dominate India instead of the Mughal or Maratha empires.